Thank you for being here with me today to bear witness to these words. I also want to thank Brian Jennings, because a year or so ago, I heard Brian speak from this pulpit, and he made a comment that stuck with me about how each one of us basically has one sermon inside of us that we share throughout our lives over and over again in different ways. I went home wondering what my one sermon would be, and I started writing it. And so, just like Brian so eloquently shares a new take on his sermon from time to time, this may well be just the first installment of mine. We'll see how this goes. Let me start with some true confessions. Even though I'm here to talk about poetry, I am not an expert on this subject by any means. I am that person sitting next to you at Shakespeare, the one who doesn't know what's going on and keeps on fidgeting, and I mean really fidgeting, and who's also ready to leave at intermission to the relief of all those around. I cannot rattle off for you the important dead white male poets, let alone deconstruct one of their poems for you, although I could maybe go on about Mother Goose. I spend my days teaching poetry, among many other things, to second graders all day long, for gosh sakes. So what am I doing here talking to all of you about poetry? This is a big risk. But I'm here to say that poetry saved my life and continues to save it again and again as part of a spiritual practice. So please let me try to explain. I grew up in a home where my words did not matter. In fact, I didn't have any words. At least I didn't think. But I found out over time that if I put a guitar on my lap and some words to music, especially if I threw Jesus in there somewhere, that I could actually say something. It took a while before I knew that lyrics were poems, and even longer before I knew that poetry is a collective celebration of the sacred. More about that later. The first poem I wrote down started like this. The unclasped hand and a baby with no name. A tree stump, a single drop sliding down a pane. I was probably about 10 or 11 when I wrote that. I can't quite remember, but I do remember it was a revolutionary act. These were actually just the first lines to a very long song with three long verses and a full chorus that eventually appeared to be all about Jesus. But really, it was about my life in a loveless place. Now, don't get me wrong. Jesus had something to do with saving me, too. Like my guitar, he provided me with a cover to saying something, and it protected me. But it wasn't until I found a slim volume of Stanyan Street and Other Sorrows by Rod McEwen that I realized that, first of all, poems didn't have to rhyme. And second of all, that you can use poems to talk about anything, and they can be stripped down of any pretense or sentiment to say what's really in your heart, and that can be amazing. it can save your life. If McEwen could write down the truth about waking up on Stanion Street, then I could write the truth about waking up on Fair Acres Drive. Although no one would believe that was the real name of my street, or that Fairplay Elementary was where I went to school. It's true. But once I realized all of that, I started listening more carefully to song lyrics, and I realized they were all made up of poetry. However, it wasn't altogether a great discovery, like when my heart broke, when I realized that my favorite song, It's Too Late, by the beloved poet Carole King, was actually about ending a relationship. And I had to take it upon myself to burn my 45 single in the backyard, because it was clear that we couldn't end relationships in my family. They were to be endured. They were to be carried around like a sack of hard rocks. And yet poems kept finding me. It's like contemporary poet Naomi Shihab Nye says in an excerpt from her poem, A Valentine for Ernest Mann. You can't order a poem like you order a taco. Walk up to the counter and say, I'll take two, and expect it to be handed back to you on a shiny plate. Still, anyone who says, here's my address, write me a poem, deserves something in reply. So I'll tell a secret instead. Poems hide. In the bottoms of our shoes, they are sleeping. They are the shadows drifting across our ceilings the moment before we wake up. What we have to do is live in a way that lets us find them. And that's what this service is about. Living in a way that opens us up to sacred words that can feed us and father us and flourish among us. I have spent a lot of years searching for poems and have found them lurking in the strangest of places. I remember sitting in a writing workshop where the poet in residence asked us each to come up with a precious object from our childhood to write about. People started talking about carved wooden boxes and old violins. But when it was my turn, I had nothing. So I just mumbled the first thing that actually, it had kept coming to my mind. But it was the word roadkill. The poet instantly wanted to know more, and I didn't know more. I just knew that I couldn't think of anything precious from my childhood in that moment. But that word, it kept surfacing like something to scrape off the bottom of my shoe. When I finally wrote and sheepishly shared the poem about driving down the road with my hair whipping and snapping until my husband slammed on the brakes while I sat mesmerized watching his hands as he picked up roadkill, caressed its wings, and eventually resurrected it into a study skin for his students, the poet exclaimed, much to my surprise, that I had written a love poem. I had no idea there was a love poem inside of me, nor that I could take one of my greatest frustrations of my early married life, that of finding dead animals in my freezer, and turn it into something as precious as an old violin. That was really lucky for my husband. And I began to see that the shame of not having what others appeared to have did not have to condemn me to nothing. That I could write my own words, that I could send myself a precious message about loving and being loved back. And it became really clear to me that poetry of any and every kind deserved a place in my life. And it was then that I discovered that my grandma Clady had not just ridden her three-wheeler around Burton, Kansas, selling insurance, but when she wasn't crashing into ditches with only a spinning wheel as a signal of where to find her, she had been a poet. She'd written a poetry column for the Burton Graphic called Clady's Corner back in the early 50s. And although it was filled with sentimental poems forced into a rhyme scheme, whether they wanted to be or not, the beauty of everyday life shone through them. The perils of not enough soap for boys' ears, of crying children, of sore and beautiful hands. They reminded me of an old picture of her holding my hand up to the camera to show off my new wedding ring. I later wrote much poetry about how her hands transformed my life. And then I also discovered Ted Kooser, the retired insurance man from Nebraska and fellow Unitarian, who wrote these exotic lines about merely peeling a potato. Pablo Casals should see me now, bowing this fat little cello, peeling off long white cords. He later was named U.S. Poet Laureate in 2004 and again in 2005, and went on to win the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry with his poems of everyday existence. Check him out. Some of my personal favorites of his are about the shedding of a snakeskin like a glittering glove of lace and giving a love poem he hopes is still warm from sitting in his back pocket. My grandma and Ted Kooser, like McEwen, both showed me the poetry in every movement and every moment. Mindfulness at its best. I could also feel in their words that somehow they were watching over me. Thomas More explains that if our fathers can't father us, sometimes literature and art can, poetry can. As a primary school teacher, I also rediscovered the legacy of nursery rhymes. And I made it my mission to make sure every second grader I knew became intimately acquainted with them. I purchased an album of 45 classic rhymes read by English children that I played over and over to ensure that my students could use them at night to put themselves to sleep. I knew that even with a free breakfast, lunch, snack, and weekend backpack program, that some of my students were going to bed hungry. But if poetry was bread, I wanted it to feed their souls. And of course, I was delighted to meet the volumes of small poems by Valerie Worth, entitled Small Poems. Small poems again, more small poems, and all the small poems, and 14 more. These captured the beauty in everything from cellophane blowing alongside the road to a lawnmower. They inspired my students to write beautiful poems like this one entitled The paperclip. The paperclip. So shiny yet so dull, as metal swerves in and out like a maze of corn. And although earlier I made it sound like teaching poetry to second graders is not that big a deal, I will tell you that their poems are fresh and raw and astonishing. So I have to share just one more, entitled Mom. She takes us to romantic places. When she smiles, her teeth are as white as mints. Her lips are as red as fingernail polish. Her hair is as smooth as a baby's head and like waves at night. Her heart hugs my heart. She smells like a watermelon. What mom wouldn't want to get that for a gift? While other students are gluing macaroni on picture frames, and we all know how important that is, my students are also crafting words to tuck into their gifts, and you can see why. In 2009, I made the trek to Boston with the Boston Bounders, better known as our junior high youth. As they toured Boston and explored their Unitarian Universalist roots, I was on my own pilgrimage to dig up some roots of my own by meeting up with a sister I hadn't seen for years. Every day that I waited, I walked from Beacon Street to downtown Boston and curled up in front of floor-to-ceiling windows in the biggest border store I'd ever seen. On the first day, I came upon a book entitled Poetry as Spiritual Practice, Reading, Writing, and Using Poetry in Your Daily Rituals, Aspirations, and Intentions by Robert McDowell. And that curled up with me. It spoke of poetry connecting us to the two most profound conversations possible, that which we have with ourselves and the one we have with the greater mystery out there, which some would call the divine. It talked of how reading poetry can make you into a tuning fork of the divine. It talked of how using poetry as an integral part of a daily spiritual practice can lead to a stillness or a calm center where we can be most open and alive. And it talked about that collective celebration of the sacred I mentioned earlier. In anticipation of meeting up with my big sister, I was often reminded of my mother. This book talked of how our mother's rhythmic breathing, heartbeat, and physical rhythms, which we know in the womb, are our earliest experiences of poetry, and how these shards of simple poetry lodge in our physiology. Wow. I took comfort in knowing that with all my mother's shortcomings, particularly her inability to protect me, she started me off with poetry as even the most broken mother does. We all come from rhythm and magic. The book also talked of how writing poetry opens windows and doors and opportunities, and so I kept writing each day as well as reading. And in doing all of this, I found myself in the midst of a profound and nurturing conversation that put my heart in a holy place. It helped me heal. From it, I was able to find a whole host of poems laying around in my life. I found Clean Sweep as I wiped my father's damning thoughts from my mind. I wrote Goodbye to God to recite as I sprinkled his ashes into the Pacific Ocean after extracting a few of the wires from his pacemaker first. I wrote about my grandma's hands and how they held me in this life, and numerous ones about my siblings and I trying our hardest to be resilient and brave. The one about the slide of my mother into death, much like the cat I named Marguerite after her. And, of course, Roadkill and several other love poems. And one of my favorites, entitled Begin, about transforming my body into poetry as I gave birth to a bouncing baby boy, just to name a few. It's not bouncing anymore. You see, when we write our words down, we get to live longer. I never tire of audibly hearing my students shock when I tell them their words can live longer than they can. To then show them how my grandmother's voice is still alive, even though she's been dead for over 30 years, is even more amazing. It's amazing to me, too, to realize I didn't even get to fully know her until I discovered her writing, and that was a long time after her death. But whether we write poetry, memoirs, or anything else, for sure we can all read poetry, and there is poetry on every topic imaginable. There are millions of messages all around us, just waiting to be found, washed up on the beaches of our lives. At the end of February, Reverend Sarah introduced us to the ancient religious practice of Lectio Divina, which consisted of the repeated reading of a sacred text for us to think about from four different angles at four different times. Now, it's true that there may have been someone, when asked later about the poem that was shared, said, "What poem?" We won't mention any names. And there may have been someone who could hear nothing in the silence but his own ears ringing. And maybe there was one who focused on the line about the light, which led them to meditate on how to fix the headlights in their car. But the beauty of that practice to me was how everyone could take the poem, that sacred text, and get out of it something all their own. Poetry holds something for each one of us. That often makes me think of my son. And how even in the days when our minds and hearts were miles apart, we shared an iTunes account, which meant our music was entangled. I actually found incredible delight in hearing that he would find himself at work with his hands elbow deep in hot water, and one of my English nursery rhymes would come blasting into his head, and he would be helpless to hit the forward button. Kind of like how he may feel right now after hearing Carole King three times. But I'm not sure if he understands, until maybe right now, that he cut his teeth on those rhymes, that he used to play with them like silly putty, turning old King Cole into old King Sol while throwing his blonde head back in a belly laugh like only a three-year-old can. I can see the threads of his love for those words into creating the lover of words that he is today and that I'm so fiercely proud of and admire as a person and a poet in his own right. But in spite of all that, I suppose it was poetic justice that I would find myself driving across town with B.J. Thomas blaring and suddenly be overcome by the earthy rhythm and lyrics of Dear God 2.0 by the Roots in their early years, of course. Dear God, I'm trying hard to reach you. Dear God, I see your face in all I do. Sometimes it's so hard to believe it. But God, I know you have your reasons too. We used to have face-offs where we would try to understand each other by playing our best lyrics to see if we could appreciate the others. And that was my only glimpse into his heart for a few years. I didn't want to understand his lyrics. As cool as I wanted to be, I had trouble looking past the profanity. But I had to admit, they would slow me down by the side of the road to take in some of the most profound poetry I'd ever heard, like a gasp of sharp breath. They broke my heart, and they broke me down. When he wrote a Mother's Day poem entitled Deadline, it started off, "As time goes on, the ticker keeps ticking. The image of younger me in your mind is still sticking. There is no replacing what you say to me and the truths that I get to see coming alive in front of me." And I wrote back in my journal, "You are a son, my son. A ray spot of light, honing your blade with words." In those words, I knew we were going to be okay. We were partaking of bread together and meeting in a holy place. The windows and doors were opening. In this season of strife in our country, where words are like hammers pounding into our temples every day, don't we need more poetry? May it be so.